Well, tonight, everyone, I want to welcome you to our leadership series of Mountain Movers Leadership Makers. And this week's panel of experts are in the mountains of government and church. You know, the Constitution, the preamble of the Constitution reads, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. And so tonight, I want to introduce to you, representing the mountain of government in the area of the judiciary, the Honorable Joyce M. Abels. How are you tonight, Joyce?
I am doing well. It is so great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you for coming tonight. The Army's mission is to deploy, fight, and win our nation's wars by providing ready, prompt, and sustained land dominance by Army forces across the full spectrum of conflict as part of the joint force. The Army mission is vital to the nation because we are the service capable of defeating enemy ground forces and indefinitely seizing and controlling those things an adversary prizes most, its land, its resources, and its population. And so tonight, representing the mountain of government for the United States Army is retired Major General Adolph McQueen. Good evening, Major General. How are you?
Good evening. I am pumped with your introduction, and I am ready to serve. Thank you.
All right. And thank you on behalf of everyone here for your service. It's just been amazing. You've served so many years. So tonight we have also the mountain of government, but we have another mountain of spirituality is the mountain of the church. And Isaiah 9:6 says that for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. And his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. And so we know tonight that as we heard the preamble to the United States Constitution, that this mountain represents the mountain for the nations. And so tonight I introduce to you the Reverend Dr. Calvin E. Robinson, Jr.
Good evening, my sister. God bless you. I'm excited to be here.
Very good. So I just want to give you all a little background on the people that you are going to hear from tonight, because it's important that you learn, but it's also very important about who you learn it from, okay? So tonight we have the Honorable Joyce M. Abels, and she's a former trial attorney, and she's a retired judge who is also a certified life coach, a professional speaker, and certified trainer. She graduated from the Ohio State University College of Law. We were actually in law school together. She was a judge in metropolitan Atlanta for 14 years, and she presided over a range of cases, including traffic offenses, major felonies, and personal injury. She currently is the founder of Her Rich Life, which is a coaching division of her company that specializes in helping high-achieving women love their lives and do work that feeds their soul. She is the creator of the Rich Life Model, a blueprint for creating a God-ordained, purpose-filled, and joy-filled life, which is the foundation for all of her coaching programs and services. So we welcome tonight the Honorable Joyce M. Abels. And then we have our Major General McQueen, who is retired from the United States Air Force. I cannot read tonight all of his background because we would be here all night. But let me say that he retired from the military service on October 1st, 2013 at Fort Sam Houston. His culminating duty was serving as the Deputy Commanding General for the support of the United States Army, North Fifth Army, from 1st of June 2012 until September 2013. He's had over 30 years of experience in the military, in his role. He's been on various posts, on various missions. In one of his posts, he oversaw thousands of soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and civilians, with overall responsibility for all detainee operations, to include the care of detainees, lawful interrogation, judicial review release boards, the prosecution of detainees in the Central Criminal Court of Iraq. detainee release transportation and coordination with the government of Iraq, the United States Embassy, the United Nations Mission, Iraq, the United Nations High Council on Refugees, the Department of Defense, the Department of State, the Department of Justice, and various other agencies. That's just a little bit of his background. But one of the things that I was most impressed about in all of the assignments that Major General Queen has had, in all of his years of service, and in all of the detention facilities he oversaw, Major General McQueen had zero escapes and zero detainee deaths under his command. He has won numerous awards by the United States Army, and so we want to welcome tonight retired Major General McQueen. How are you tonight, sir?
I am doing great.
Wonderful. We are so glad to have you here. And we have been talking about, and I want to thank you on behalf of everyone here tonight, because we know that your time, as ours, your time is very valuable. But we felt that you had something that you could deposit tonight because of all of your leadership experience. So I want to start tonight, and I'm going to start with Joyce Abels, Judge
okay.
Abels. I'm going to start with her tonight. And I want to ask you, how did you know, or when did you know, that you wanted to be an attorney, that you wanted to be a judge? How did that path start? And, you know, usually sometimes it comes from a time of a child or experience that we've had. But we'd like to find out tonight kind of who you are. So,
okay.
Judge Abel, we'll start with you.
All right, thank you. That's an interesting story. I tell it all the time. I was 12 years old, and I decided that I was going to be the next Perry Mason. Because, of course, I knew no attorneys, but I liked what he did, and I thought, I can do that. I know I can do that, and I can be good at it. So we had a career day at our school, and there was an attorney there, and he talked about going to law school and passing the bar and becoming a trial attorney. And I was so excited. I ran home and I told my mother, I said, Ma, I am going to be an attorney. And she said, you know, she didn't bat an eye. She said, okay, that sounds good to me. That sounds fine. The only problem was I had also shared this information with my guidance counselor. And she told me she didn't think that was a good idea. She thought I would be better suited to be a nurse or a teacher. And I was 12, and so I didn't think a whole lot about it. I thought, well, I'm an A student. I'm smart. Well, surely I can do this. So I didn't give it any more thought, but I also shared that with my mom. And she went down to the school the next day, and I heard my name over the loudspeaker. I needed to come to the principal's office. It's like, what? So I go to the principal's office, and there's my mother and the guidance counselor and the principal. And she explained to this guidance counselor, she said, do not ever dampen my child's dreams. If she says she wants to fly on wings to the moon, all you need to do is nod. Do not ever tell her what she cannot do. So I learned a couple of things that day. First of all, my mother believed in me, and she supported my dreams. And I also learned I could do whatever I wanted to do. And so this little girl who saw Perry Mason, you know, in a courtroom on a TV, decided that she was going to be that, she was going to do that, and that's what I did. Everything I did from the time I was 12 years old was so that I could get into law school. I didn't have any idea where I was going or how I was going to get there, but I knew I was going to law school, and one day I was going to stand in front of juries, and I was going to try cases, and that's what I did.
Wow. Joyce, that's an awesome story. I love your mother. I love it. So everyone on here that has a child or you have a grandchild, You be careful what people speak over them. Absolutely phenomenal. Major General McQueen, when did you decide that you were going to give this life of service to the military and to the Army in particular?
I started off early as a young private, which is the lowest rank you can be in the military. And having been in the military for about several years, I realized that my leaders above me did not create the conditions for not only me to succeed, but all of the folks that were around me that were competent but never had an opportunity. So I went ahead and read the regulation and found out that there was a regulation that I could get a direct commission based on my experience and my college degree. I applied and was given this direct commission as a lieutenant. And from then on, I just started working hard, and I was a man of faith. And I started taking the hard job. And every hard job that I had taken on, the Lord blessed me. And it got to a point where I was now leading men and women all over the world. And so I had to redefine myself as not only a leader, but I had to create some things for me to succeed and for those around me. So I'm just going to give you three points, and then I'll come back to them later. I had to operate in the spirit of excellence. I also had to have water walking faith. And then the third thing is I had the ministry of presence. And I backed all of these three principles with Bible verses that helped guide me through my career. That's it.
Wow. Now, how did you decide, before you started in the military, when did you make the decision to go in the military? And why did you make the decision to go into the military?
I went into the military because at the time the economy was down and I just needed a break. I grew up in Detroit and I just needed an opportunity to start all over again. And I didn't have a degree at the time I entered the military, but while I was in the military, I did get a degree. And then that's when I decided I wanted to move forward. And when you serve at a point where you can help American sons and daughters, mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers, I've had that opportunity and I've lived it and I've enjoyed it.
Wow. Wow. Well, we are going to go to Reverend Dr. Calvin E. Robinson, Jr., and I want to tell you, because he's representing the Mountain of Religion or the church tonight, and I want to tell you a little bit about him before he answers the question about how and when he decided to do what he is doing. But Dr. Robinson, he's a minister with a passion for helping people, and he believes that family is the key building block of God's beloved community. He has been led to challenge men to be priests of their homes and lead their families in worship and living the life that Christ has instructed us to live. And he teaches that husbands and wives should exude love for one another in every facet of life, have a deep commitment of supporting and submitting to one another, and sharing responsibility in raising and nurturing their children, which are gifts from God. Dr. Robinson's ministerial travels of preaching and teaching have taken him across the United States, San Juan, Puerto Rico, and the continent of Africa. Dr. Robinson has conducted seminars on fatherhood and marriage on the national level for the administration of children and families and Head Start on the state and local level. He also teaches at the state level doctrine, theology, homiletics, and creative ways of teaching. He is a teacher certified by the National Baptist Convention, USA, Inc. He has a great love for his community, and he is involved with various organizations to assist the homeless, the elderly, the abused, the incarcerated, and those seeking to further their education and economic development. And Pastor Robinson states that being called by God to preach the gospel is the greatest honor in his life. Pastor Robinson.
Yes, my sister.
We'd like to hear from you. Tell us, how and when did you decide? Because Dr. Pastor Robinson is also a veteran, and I want to thank you for your service. He is a veteran of the United States Air Force. And so we'd like to hear your story tonight of how you decided to take on this mountain of the church, which rules the nation, which literally rules the nation. When and how did you decide that?
Well, my grandmother, if she were alive, she would tell you that it started when I was a child. But early in my life, I ran from the ministry. I thought that the Air Force was going to be my career. And I had a blessed time in the Air Force as a junior officer. I was blessed to be one of the first honor graduates of Air Force ROTC at South Carolina State College at that time. And I just knew that that was what was in my future. While I was at the Pentagon, I worked in the command center during Desert Storm. And somehow I lost my passion for the military, but the military is a great place. And I was blessed, but something was missing. And about a year before the Majors Board, I got out of the Air Force and worked as a civilian. And my spiritual life began to grow. And I left the AME church and joined a Baptist church and ended up becoming a deacon a few years later. But there was this pull. I was happy being a deacon, being a Sunday school teacher, and trying to make as much money as I could in the corporate world. But there was this pull. I was not happy in the corporate world. And so when you have this hunger, and then God began to show me what he wanted me to do. And I had this wonderful opportunity in D.C. To sign up with this company and make a really, really good salary back about 20 years ago. And I turned it down. And I knew what God wanted me to do. And so I answered his call into the ministry. And I knew that money was not important to me anymore, but it was about doing what God wanted me to do, and that was to pastor God's people and to serve. And so when sitting at my desk one day and read a verse of scripture from Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, and I said one day, I said to myself, that is a wonderful two verses for somebody to look at, a wonderful pericope for somebody to look at and write a sermon. And God said, not somebody, but you.
Mm.
So I got up from my desk and put my jacket on because tears were running down my cheeks. And I went outside in the parking lot and looked up at an overcast sky in Northern Virginia and said, Lord, I yield. And I haven't stopped running yet for him.
And you certainly have not. And I want to say this because I think this is important as we're talking to people. In between that time, you went on and you earned a doctorate. Was your doctorate in
Correct.
Theology?
A doctorate in youth ministry, social action. The title of my
Wow.
dissertation was How the Church Can Encourage and Equip Youth Ages 11 to 14 to Avert Illicit Drug Activity.
Wow. Wow. You know, I say that because I want people to know that as we're talking tonight, we're talking about people who have really have been trailblazers in a lot of different ways. And just as, you know, when you went to school and decided to further your education and particularly write that dissertation in reference to youth, that is still a major component in our society today to really advance our youth. But I want to find out from you all tonight, and everyone's interested in finding out about this issue of leadership. And we know that right now we are in a crisis in this country and actually the world. The world is in the middle of a crisis, mm-hmm. and we see that, you know, in the middle of a crisis, you really need great leadership. So I want you to think about over your years, really, what is the most difficult leadership challenge that you've had over the years, and how did you overcome that leadership challenge? And we're going to go in the same order. We're going to start with Judge Abrams, and then we're going to go to Major General McQueen, and then we're going to go to Dr. Robinson.
Okay. I thought of a couple of things, so I'll start with the first one. First of all, I want to say that I was not one of these people who automatically at the beginning felt like I was a leader. And it wasn't until somebody else said to me, you do know that you're the leader, right? And I thought about, you know, all of the things, the groups that I had been a part of, and this kind of thing. And I noticed that I always ended up being in charge, which was funny because my brothers would always say when I was younger, people would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up. And before I could tell them the whole lawyer story, they would always say, she just wants to be in charge. Just let her be in charge. She'll be okay. But I remember, so over the years, as time went on, I started leaning into that whole idea of being a leader and being in charge and being the one to make the tough decisions. And so I was thinking about this question and how I was going to answer it tonight, I thought about one of the first mistakes I made when I was first appointed to the bench. For the first couple of years, I was an associate judge in the traffic court in DeKalb County, Georgia. And after a while, the man who had been the chief judge went on to the next court. He got a promotion up, and so I took his place and I became the chief judge. And so with my gung-ho self, not being in charge of a court before or being in charge of people who were so much older than me, most of everybody in the staff and the other judges were older than I was, I decided I was just going to whip everything into shape, and I had a plan, and this is how I was going to do it. And I got to working my plan. And so one of the first things I did was I got the clerk of the court and all of the deputy clerks, and we all got together and we went to Stone Mountain for this leadership retreat. And we worked on our vision and our mission and our goals and plans for the court. And we had a great time. Everything went well. You know, the PowerPoints all worked. We had the flow charts and everything was fine. And we got back to the court, and it was time to implement what we had done, and there was a big disconnect. And so one of the first things I learned as being a leader is you do not lead from the top down. That's not how it works, and especially not in that situation. That should have been handled differently, because what happened was everybody else who did not go on that retreat kind of looked at us and said, oh, so you all decided this is how it's going to be. What about this, or what about that? Or, you know, they had some ideas that were really good that I should have given them the example to share with us, and I had not. And so I learned from that experience, that's not how you do that. You know, that is not how, if you're in any kind of group and you're in a leadership position, it is so important to get feedback from everyone who is going to be affected by these things. And a much better outcome happened when we got everybody together, and we just had a retreat for the whole court. We shut down for a day, and that's what we did. And everybody bought into what we were trying to put into place without me trying to basically shove it down their throats. That never works. And it makes for an unhappy workplace. People feel belittled. They don't feel like they matter. And I really didn't want them to feel that way. I mean, I really didn't. That was never my intention. But I just thought, you know, hey, I'm in charge. I know what's best. And no, I did not. I did not. And so I learned a great lesson from that. And that's something. And I'm glad I learned it early in my judicial career, because as time went on and I did other things, I was able to take that knowledge and bring it into, I started an online ministry, I started a nonprofit for middle school girls, and now I'm in business. And so I still remember those lessons. And so that is one thing that I really wanted to share and hope that it can benefit someone else who might be facing the same type of situation. If you're not getting buy-in from your people, the people that you're supposed to be leading. And remember, first and foremost, leadership is about being a servant. You know, I'm a Christian. I'm a believer. And I believe in the teachings of Jesus. He was a servant. That's how he led. And so that's how I want to lead. And that's how, and that was a humbling experience. And that really taught me that, you know, if you believe in this whole servant leadership thing, then you need to put it into action. And so that, like I said, it was a big mistake, and I'm glad I learned it early in my career.
I love that, because Joyce, you covered a couple of things. You covered, you know, this issue of just because I'm the named leader doesn't mean I know everything. There are other people who do have ideas, and like you said, I don't have to shove it down their throat when they are a part of it. And it's so much easier to cast vision and get buy-in when you've taken in and taken on the other, you know, ideas of other people. But I love the fact too, you didn't stop. Now you didn't stop serving, and you didn't stop on your judicial climb just because of that failure or that mistake.
Oh no.
Right. So I want people to know that, because there are people saying, "You know, how do I get over that?" So, Joyce, you kind of felt like you had mud on your face, but how did you get over that? Did you have to come back? How did you come back into the group and what you realized the mistake and kind of move that in a different direction?
Once I realized the mistake I made, I said, you know, I've got to fix this or we're going to have a big problem. And so I called a meeting in my courtroom, and I had everybody to come. I bought lunch, you know, let's bribe people a little bit, you know, this kind of thing. Let's get them in a good mood. And I said, from the bottom of my heart, I am so sorry. I apologize. I messed up. And it didn't, you know, those weren't the exact words, but that's basically what I said. And I said, you know, but there are some ways that we can fix that. And I do want your input. So now that we know what doesn't work, can I have some suggestions of what might work? How could we do this differently so that everybody will feel included? And I got some great ideas. And so that's what led to the court-wide retreat that we had. Everybody was able to come and feel like they were a part. And I have to tell you, up until I left that court and went on to the next level, people knew what our vision and our mission was because they bought into it and they believed in it. And so that was it. So that's how I turned it around. I had to admit my mistake and I had to admit it to them. I couldn't just say, oh Lord, I'm sorry. I really messed up. I did say that, but then I also had to tell them I messed up. Let's fix this.
Wow. And we're finding that that's consistent with the leaders that we've heard from, to go back and say, you know what, I messed up, I'm sorry, and go in the right direction. Now, I'd like to know from Major General McQueen, is it different in the military? In the military, is it different from what Judge Abel said? And what were your, would you consider your leadership challenges over the years?
Well, in the military, it's both what the judge said, and there's different ways of doing things.
Okay.
For me, as I left the staff rank and became a leader, it started off when I was in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. That's where they held all of the terrorists, and I was the second commander to come in there, and I fell into an operation that had no policies and procedures, and I'm in charge of terrorists from all over the world. The official number was probably, say, north over 700 with about 21 different countries. And I was faced with a challenge to change the culture of the organization, because what I was responsible for was the reputation of the United States all over the world. So I had a number of, if you name a governmental organization, they all had to deal with me. And so I had to define myself. I had to figure out who I was and what I was going to do in order to do this job. And so as I talked earlier, I sat down and I prayed to the Lord, and I said, in everything that I do, the Lord needs to bless me on this. So I came up with changing the culture of my organization, and I started off with a spirit of excellence, and the Lord led me to a Bible verse of 2 Corinthians chapter 8 verse 7. In essence, it talks about excel in everything. So I brought the team together and I said, look, we have to build policies and procedures that will make this organization stand over time. And so we included, if you were a cook, you wrote the cook policy. If you were a guard, you wrote the guard policy. And so every operation of that facility, I had buy-in to write policies. And once we wrote the policies and refined them, then we published them. And that changed the entire culture, because everyone understood how we were going to operate. and everyone that came to see the facility. And as you know, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, is still in existence today. And that's because of the foundation that we put together. Even though there's been different commanders, the basic foundation of how we put that together and how we built the culture is still there. And then I went on and I've led detention facilities all over the world. And I was responsible for the policies all over the world. And we've always been successful. And my folks says, like, the second principle I use is that you have to be a water walker in faith, meaning that everything that you do, faith will drive you and make you know that you can be successful as long as you have faith. And again, all of these problems I'm having, I'm going to my Bible. And I found chapter 14, verses 25 and 29. When Peter walked on water, it was because he had faith. Jesus walked on water, but he asked Peter to come out, and Peter had faith. So I believe that everything that I did in the detention facility, God was blessing me, and I had faith in my people, and I instilled in them that we had to succeed. And then the third thing that tied everything together was, I call it the ministry of presence. People have to know who you are. So I walked around every facility I've ever operated on a day-to-day basis. I walked around and talked to the people. They knew who I was, and what I wanted to do. Every Sunday, they knew I was going to be in church. And so if they needed to get after me, they knew they could see me in church if they wanted to go what we call without outside the chain of command. If they stood outside the church doors, they could get me because they knew I was there every Sunday, regardless of whether I was in Guantanamo, Iraq, or Afghanistan, or Korea. I made that a point. So culture was big for me in the detention facilities. You have to change the culture so folks buy in and understand what you do. One of the things that I really had a problem with was I had a lack of mentors. Didn't have a whole lot of people that wanted to be mentors and didn't know how to be mentors. And because I didn't have a mentor, it was hard for me to mentor other folks other than being mission driven. But there came a time that I did learn about being a mentor, and I started mentoring people to the point where I've probably sat on more promotion boards than anybody in the entire Army, what we call promotion boards at every rank, because the Army and the leadership knew that I had the character of looking at records and promoting people. So every promotion board that we sat on, we always maxed out the number of slots that were available for minorities and females, because I made sure that when you have authority, responsibility comes with it.
Major General, that is so good. There's so much to unpack there. Let me ask you this before we move on to Dr. Robinson. In terms of the mentor, what do you look for, or what did you look for in a mentee? Were there certain things that you looked for in a mentee? I mean, there are people that you came in contact with, I mean, thousands of people, a lot of people that you could mentor. I'm sure there are people that you know you've mentored in a general sense, but the people that you've mentored up close and personal, were there specific things you were looking for in your mentee, in a potential mentee?
Yes, I was looking for the ability to want to learn and want to work hard and to be well-rounded, because some things you will learn through the educational field and some things you will just learn by talking to people and hearing their experiences. And then being able to take the stories from that they tell and basically use them, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. Perfect sense. Reverend Dr. Robinson, tell us about leadership for you. You've heard, Joyce Abels and Judge Abels, and you've heard Major McQueen, General McQueen. Are there differences in the church world than what you heard? And I heard a lot of scripture and biblical principles in what they said, but tell us about your leadership and the difficulties that or challenges that you may have had in leadership over the years and how you overcame those.
Oh, my. Well, being a junior officer in the military and working in the corporate world, I can definitely tell you that in order to effect a cultural change in the church, it is much different than in the military or the corporate world. In a leadership position that's not having to do that's in the corporate world or in the military, the culture changes, I say, quicker, because when the people fall in line with the leader because of who he or she is and because of what they see. But when you're dealing with a spiritual realm, changing the culture at a church is a very difficult thing to do. And I found out that the hard way, that you can love people, but they're not necessarily going to love you back because they have to love themselves first. And so it's like I teach people, you know, in relationships, a man can't make a woman love him no matter what he does for her. And a woman can't make a man love her no matter what she does. And we can go into detail about that another day and time. But I found that a pastor can be broken if he or she pours all of himself or herself into the ministry and the people just don't get it. When I first got into ministry, I found I wasn't the person who created this term, but there's something called the social club mentality in the church. And to try and get that culture to change takes time and it takes effort. But there's a term in talking about youth ministry. Gregory Ellison out of Emory University said that pedagogical patience is something that we need to understand. That your job is to plant the seed. Somebody else is going to come along and water it, and God will give the increase. So a pastor can drive himself or herself crazy trying to affect a cultural change in a number of years. You just can't do it. When I was in the corporate world, I could, you know, take over a department and within 6 months change the culture because of, you know, using certain leadership principles. But that doesn't happen in the church. Most of us believe that it takes 5 to 7 years to become the pastor, because unfortunately there's some people have to get out of the way.
How do you do that? Because I have heard that also, that, you know, that 5 to 7 or 7 to 8 years to actually become, even though you're the named person, to become the pastor of the church. But are there leadership principles, though, that work in the church just as well as they do in the secular? It may take longer. It may take longer for various reasons and culturally, but work just as well. For example, The principle of trusting the leader.
Yes, yes. What I have found is that when as a pastor, when I admit that I'm human, when I admit that I can make a mistake in leading the flock, and I heard the honorable judge say that. So if one were to go in and say, you know, there's God, then there's me, the pastor. You know, that's baloney. We're human. And we're going to make mistakes in leading people. But when you let people know, listen, I'm human too, and we're all going to pray and work together. When people see that you love them, most of them now, remember, I had a really bad experience where it didn't matter. But when the people see that you love them as a whole, when you sacrifice for them, and they see that you're not using them as a stepping stone or a building block to get a promotion, if you will, they tend to buy into it. I also found that I learned something called concept of leaving the door open for people, because everybody's not going to accept you the moment you walk in the door and become installed as the pastor. And they may rise up against you, but a wise deacon who's gone on to glory now taught me, he said, Pastor, don't ever slam the door on people. Leave the door ajar, and they'll come back in. And so what I found out, that love and patience and caring and understanding will go a long way. One can be very well educated, but one has to have love for God's people in order to effectively be a pastor. Teachers have to love students. Generals have to love their people, love soldiers and love soldiering. People have to have a passion for the law. And when you have that passion, that's the important thing. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, yep, one of my favorites, spoke about having passion, vice compassion. Bonhoeffer said that when one has compassion, one will see the carts, and he was referring to the Nazis, rolling over people. And when you have compassion, you go and you pick the people up after the cart has rolled over them. But he said when you have a passion, you stand in front of the cart to stop the cart from rolling over the people. That's the passion Jesus had for us. So a pastor has to have passion.
Wow. You know, that is so good. I mean, there were so many principles from, you know, Judge Avril's tonight, and from, you know, our resident military person, retired Major General McQueen, and even to yourself, Pastor, in reference to how to lead people. And a couple of things that I heard that I'd like you, any of you, to comment on, in terms of knowing yourself, and I'm going to start with you, Dr. Robinson. What would you consider that you consider a failure as a pastor on your part at any given time, and how did you move past that, and how did you deal with that with the people? Is there any particular thing that you, because there are a lot of people that say they can't, they're afraid to get up, and they're afraid to do, and they're afraid to move forth because they're afraid of failure. You know, Judge Avril told us about the failure of including people. You know, you just can't include a few people. She included some people. She included her, you know, top people and people around her, but she didn't include the whole. And when she came back, they were willing to readily accept it. So is there a time that you think I should have included, or some other leadership issue that you had, and then you had to find a way to overcome that, move past that, and to bring the people along with you?
I would say bringing in more of a corporate type of leadership trait into pastoring, and trying to will a culture change. You can't will a change in the church, especially when people have been indoctrinated to a certain type of culture for a long period of time. And so I was almost broken trying to make that happen. But I learned that it takes an awful lot of prayer and asking God for wisdom and learning to back off when one runs up against a wall. Back off and come at another angle later on to effect a change. I'm saying it almost broke me emotionally trying to effect a change. And because when you're new, brand new in the ministry, you want to go in like, you know, wide open, like I said, like a pony out in a fresh green meadow. You're just running, all excited. Lord, I thank you for allowing me into this position to help people. But we have to learn the people and learn that particular culture. And that was hard for me to accept at first. And then I learned to take it easy. You're not going to turn around the culture in a particular congregation in a few months or just a couple of years. It takes time. The old ship of Zion turns slowly.
So it takes time. And time is something that we have to be patient with. And I want to ask Judge Avril's and Major General McQueen. General McQueen, let's start with you first. Because you've led a tremendous number of people, not only in one particular area, but really across the world. How did you utilize one of the things that you said that was really powerful, you were talking about doing, when you got ready to do policies and procedures, you didn't do the policies and procedures yourself necessarily. If the person worked in the kitchen, you had the kitchen people do the policies and procedures. So there's a principle that just really runs through that. Tell us, how do you lead? I've read that you have led, I mean, in certain areas, you've led 14,000 soldiers at a time, and I'm sure more than that. How do you actually lead that many people? How do you use the other people around you in leading that many people?
Well, that's a big question. Again, people knew who I was. That built a reputation all over the world. People knew that I was. I'm gonna go to Daniel. I leaned on Daniel for a lot. The book of Daniel, chapter 6, and you know how Daniel worked hard, but yet he still had enemies that didn't like him.
Yeah.
And working in a prison or running a prison, my intent always was to do good. But there was always people that did not like what I was doing on both sides, the folks that were prisoners and the folks that were on my side. So I basically just, again, with defining who I was in the ministry of presence, is once you have procedures in place, and I went around my whole life, I said that every organization, and even myself, should grow every day. Every day you should, as you reinvent yourself, you should add one thing to your life every day. In the enemies, Al-Qaeda used to talk about, we measure victory 1 inch at a time. And when I read that, I said, it makes sense. It doesn't have to be a big step. It could be a small step. So every day, as you're leading people, you have to, again, define who you are, and then you have to grow in areas that you are weak in. You have to grow every day, just a little bit. You don't take it on, and then over time, you would have amassed a number of principles that will allow you to serve. And again, it was always my reputation. When I deployed soldiers all over the world, the night before they were to be put on an airplane to go to an area of conflict, I would fly in and talk to those young soldiers. I would shake all of their hands when they got on the airplane, shook some of their hands, hugged others, and I told them that I gave them the best training that I possibly could give them. And when they were in areas of conflict, just trust the training. And I told them when they returned, I would be right there welcoming them back. And God blessed me in a sense that everybody that I put on an airplane and sent to Afghanistan, Iraq, all over the world, came back.
Why was that important to you? Why was that important to you to look at them, to shake their hands, to hug them, and to tell them that? Why was that important to you?
It was important to them because I wanted them to know that I cared for them, that I loved them, and that I provided every opportunity for them to be successful as a group and as an individual. Does that make sense?
Wow. That makes plenty of sense. So that is important as a leader. That is so important as a leader. I love that. Judge Abrams, tell me the role that personal growth has played. You know, Major General McQueen was just talking about this growth and growing every day. And you sat on the bench and you heard cases from felonies to, you know, starting out with traffic and felonies over a period of 14 years. And now you're in the business realm, coaching women into their best life. What role did personal growth play in your evolution from the bench into business? And when did that start for you? When did that concept of personal growth start for you? And even how was that utilized, if it was, when you were sitting on the bench?
Personal growth for me started, years before I even got on the bench. But once I became a judge, it sort of shifted into high gear. Because one of the things that I found about leadership for me is that not only does it show my areas of strength, it also shows me my areas of weaknesses. Mm. And in order to maximize the strengths and minimize the weaknesses or overcome the weaknesses or improve the weaknesses, make them into strengths, that all depended on me growing personally, intellectually, professionally, and all of those kinds of things. I remember as I was still on the bench when I was still doing some training work on the side, if you will. I taught executive women, court executives, women, leadership and communication skills. And I thought, well, you know what? This would be a good idea for a company. And I thought I knew everything I needed to know. And I did know, as the old people would say, I had the book smarts. I had the book knowledge about that. But I did not know about the other things that would go into trying to create that whole business idea. And so I learned from that experience early on that, first of all, I don't know everything. And the second thing is that it's okay to ask for help. As a type A, let's get it done, do it yourself kind of person. I know you're laughing, right? I have come to understand in my old age, as they say, that no,
you're not old.
I know. I just say that facetiously. I don't think of myself as being old anymore. If somebody had asked me, 30 years ago, when you reach 61, would you be old? I would say, oh, yeah, now, I'm not old. But I had to grow personally to understand. Well, I had to understand a couple of things. First of all, when I don't ask someone else for help, I'm not allowing that person who could help me to exercise their gifts. So not only am I holding back my blessing, but I'm holding back the blessings for someone else. And so as I grew into leadership and grew personally, I learned these things. And of course, it never got to a perfect place. I'm still not perfect. I don't think that I ever will be. But over the years, I have transitioned from season to season, and I do see growth. And it's very important to keep learning and keep growing even now, and especially now in having a business. It's very important that I understand that as a leader, I have a team. I have a team that I should lead, that I have to interact with, that I have to ask for help, that I have to make into a real team and not just, a group of people who tend to, come and work together every now and then. And personal growth is important for me, it's important for them, and if we're going to accomplish things, then we have to grow as a team together. And so personal growth has played a big part in my life from as long as I can remember. And when it comes to being a leader, it's something that I think you never really master 100%. It's a growth kind of thing, and you keep growing and growing and growing. Because as you move up in leadership, the things that you learn about yourself, about your strengths, about your weaknesses, they increase as well. And so you're always growing and you're always trying to know more and do more and learn more.
Wonderful. Now, I could spend like another hour, 2 hours with you all, but I want you to have a closing statement tonight. And I want you to, if you were to sum it up for people in reference to leadership, and you were to leave them with something that, a lot of times I say, if you don't remember anything else, I'd like you to remember this. What is that thing you would like people to remember in reference to leadership, number one? And number two, there are many of us, we know that there are leaders and that lead people, and there are leaders that produce other leaders. As we look at our youth today, because every single one of you on this panel has had some involvement with youth, what would be your advice in raising up youth leaders, not in the church, but people who in the church too, but people who lead, who are youthful now because it's a different generation. They operate differently. They tend to think a little differently. They move through the world a little differently. What advice would you give? And I'm going to start with Major General McQueen. What advice would you give? What would you want people to remember tonight? And then what advice would you give in terms of raising up young people into leadership?
I would like to be, I told my soldiers my last assignment, we were, the mantra was, we were champions with character. And all of you know, in the sports arena, our young people today, they all view champions. You know, you've got champions in football, baseball. And so a number of people cling to wanting to be a champion. But I added with character, because there's a difference. You can have character is who you are. And character is who other folks know who you are. And so if you're going to be the best in any field, if you want to lead, you must have character. Because people will talk about you in your in front of you, behind you, and all around you. But if you've got character like Daniel, when all of his enemies came against him, they said, he's not corrupt. So even though they tried to tear him down, they couldn't find anything to take him apart. So they had to admit that he was not corrupt. And that's all a part of what I say, be a champion and have character when you're doing that. That's
wonderful.
That's what I have.
Thank you, Doc. Thank you so much. Dr. Robinson, what would you leave people with tonight? And what would you say about leading this next generation? Bring them into leadership. What would you leave the people with tonight?
In a word, humility. I believe that great leaders should evince humility in how they conduct themselves. And the general nailed it perfectly when he talked about character. I am really big on humility. And humility is something that you saw in Jesus the Christ. He walked this earth humble, passionate about what he does, what he did, and what he does still yet. Amen. And caring about people. Our young people growing, coming up now, who aspire to leadership, and I've witnessed some brilliant young people. In high school, in college, in law school, in medical school, have a passion for what one does. When I was young, I was encouraged to find something to do that was going to make a lot of money. But I think that our young people should go into a field where they're passionate about, if you're passionate about I think the natural leadership traits are going to come forward. Care about what you're doing. Care about how you're doing it, and do it for the good of humanity. Whatever that is that one desires to do, do it for the good of humanity. To better lead this earth better than how you found it.
Wow.
That's what I would say.
Thank you so much. And we're going to end with the Honorable Joyce Abel. What would you leave people with tonight? And what would you say on the youth issue?
Okay, first, I would say to the first part of your question, my favorite scripture is John 17:4. And it says that I brought you glory on earth by finishing the work you gave me to do, and that's Jesus talking to the Father. And I believe that every position I've ever had in life, and it's true for anybody else in leadership, God has allowed that to happen. And if I want to glorify him, live out my purpose, do the things that he's called me to do, then as a leader, I need to be able to do those things and do them well, always being reminded that he is the person that put me where I am, and that what I'm doing as far as a leader goes is a reflection of my relationship with him, and it's a reflection of how I think about him and how I worship him and honor him. As far as the young people goes, I think Dr. Robinson made great points about the whole humility issue, because I think for, especially for this generation, you have to walk your talk. It's, you cannot say one thing and do something else, because we know how to talk about leadership. You know, we do, but we have to model that. And it takes a humble person sometimes to do that, because these kids, raising up leaders today is a whole lot different. I've worked with kids since I was in high school, and I've seen the formation from where they were years ago to the kids that they are now. They're more aware. They are, and I guess more intelligent. They are hypervigilant, and they are always watching. And they will call you out on your stuff. And so if we're working with young people or we're leading young people, it's very important to be humble enough to say, you know what, I've got to be transparent and I've got to do this right, because not only does my life depend on this, but these people who are entrusted to me for this season, theirs do too. And so I think it's very important to be that person that you keep saying that you are, to do the things that God has called you to do, and we'll be fine. They'll be fine.
Wow. Thank you all. I want to thank you all tonight, Judge Averill, yes. Major General McQueen, and Reverend Dr. Robinson. I want to thank you all for joining us tonight. You have added so much value, and we just really want to, as we say goodbye tonight, we wanted to say thank you. We have been studying leadership, and we have been talking about it, but to see people who are actually moving and have moved into the levels of leadership that you have, and for you to come and to deposit into this group and to be so congruent in these leadership principles, we really want to thank you. We really want to thank you. You have deposited gold tonight. We are just praying for you as you continue to lead in your respective areas, in your homes, in your families, in your community. Thank you so much.